You're listening to the Puyallup Native Radio Program. Audio files are available online at nativetalk.net. If you listen to the whole show today, beginning to end, you'll become the first person to ever do it. And that's something you can brag about to your friends. Unless you're Cliff, and then you don't have any. Be a part of the program by emailing us, podcast@nativetalk.net. And now, your hosts, Cliff and Brandon. Crank it up and set off your airbag.
What?
Now grab your nets and let's go fishing.
Good morning. Thank you for joining us today for the Native Talk Radio Podcast. As always, you can be a part of the program by emailing us podcast@nativetalk.net. Also visit us online, of course, to download all of our past shows. Now, today I wanted to do something just a little bit different and go all the way back to December of 2015, so a couple of years, and we want to play a podcast that we were doing before we'd even come up with an idea for Native Talk. All right, so this is a completely different podcast. Now, I usually don't play audio from that period of time, and the first reason being our equipment was so much worse than it is now, which is why you're going to hear the sound quality suddenly drop in just a few moments. But the other reason is normally there aren't too many topics from that show that make sense to carry over to this one. But this is a different story, and it's one that I absolutely believe has lessons that we can learn from and apply to our lives today. Now, it centers in on one of the saddest facts that I've ever read, and that is Native American poverty. Now, some tribes, like mine, are doing quite well, while other tribes report an unemployment rate of up to 85%, while Natives overall represent the lowest employment rates of any ethnic group in the country. Now, the jobs that they do get are often limited to tribal government jobs, and they don't have a lot of other opportunity. Now, that doesn't stop Natives from having the desire and the dream of improving their lives and the lives of their families. Now, I believe that we all want success, and actually, I should point out that success looks different to every individual. It doesn't necessarily have to be money, fame, fortune, things like that. Success is not always, you know, owning a giant thriving business, flying a private jet all over the world with millions of dollars in the bank. Sometimes success might just have a good job that brings you happiness, pays the bills, enough to eat, and the ability to spend your spare time in the garden. You know, so whatever your definition of success is, don't put it into like a box. You know what I mean? If you have a passion in your life, that is success to you. And so whatever it means to you, I think that every one of us has had the opportunity to fall on hard times at some point in our lives. And when those hard times come, it's easy to feel like life is over. And it's tough to get back up and walk that long, hard road back to where you really want to be. Sometimes you're not even sure if you're going to make it. And that's when an inspirational story like the one we're going to tell today hopefully can lift your spirits. Because even rich folks fall on hard times, just like we do, and they find themselves on the brink of losing everything they own. But determination, strength of spirit, can help you hold on and get through to better times. So the best advice I can say, don't give up. Now, there was a controversy back in December of 2015 that I saw on television, which prompted me to write a letter to this man. We're going to tell his story today, and he wrote me back. Today's show will begin by telling you about the controversy that prompted me to write, and then we'll switch to kind of a history lesson and tell you about how he almost lost everything in the 1980s and came to be one of the richest men alive today. So I truly hope that you'll find hope and inspiration in the next hour, and that you'll, I can tell you, you're definitely going to hear an interesting tale. So I hope you stick around for that full hour. Believe me, you are not going to be disappointed. So here's our show from December 10th, 2015. Everybody knows what Texas is all about, right? It's a pretty well-known state.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's kind of your most stereotypical state outside of California. When people think of the United States, you're either a cowboy or a surfer. You know, I think that's how they people
that's what
see
they or a New Yorker.
Yeah, or yeah, you got to be some Boston, right?
Well, we're going to be talking a little bit about Texas today because it's such a well-known state, and it really is a piece of America. When you look at the map, I mean, it like jumps out at you.
Yeah, yeah. If you were, you know, because of the way they're able to project maps, it looks like the biggest state in the country.
Yeah, you know what the biggest state actually is, though, right?
I believe it's Alaska.
It is Alaska, but Texas, of course, is the biggest state in the, you know, the
main,
yeah, the continental United States. Well, right. Check out all the latest information online at theenglishexpress.com, where today's audio file will be posted right after the show. And it is Thursday morning at just after 10 o'clock.
9 o'clock.
That's in California. Here in Colorado, which is the time that we base it off of, it's after 10 o'clock in the morning. So, Brennan, can you tell me how you feel about art?
What type of art?
Like
just
kind of
art in general?
Art.
So just people expressing themselves through a medium?
No, like traditional art.
Well, and that's what I'm confused about, why I asked what type, because traditional art can be stage performance, it can be sculpting, it can be painting, you know, I mean, there's many traditional forms of art. Which one are you talking about?
Well, let's say paintings.
Sure. I think that painting is a great tool to explore different feelings, also different representations of what you see. And I think it's great for kids, too. It's a way for them to learn how to write without using a pencil. You know, it teaches those same muscle areas. And so that way it can teach them how to write and become successful in school with something as fun as smearing colors on a page.
Is there any art that's not good?
You mean like indie films?
Not what I was thinking, but yes, that is bad. No, like let's say, for example, you saw a painting that you really enjoy. You go, hey, that's a pretty cool painting. And they say it was painted by Adolf Hitler. Would you like to buy it?
The artist itself wouldn't deteriorate the work to me, because I would judge the painting based on what it is, not who did it. So I don't think I'm gonna like take it to my home and anyone who's not blonde hair and blue eyed, you know, gets immediately executed. I don't think the painting's gonna do that. So I would be okay if it was the right price and the right painting.
Okay, so you'd buy it.
If like I said, right painting, right price, yeah.
Now what would you say about somebody who visited your house and let's say the media found out about it and they started saying, how dare you go to Brandon's house? Did you know that he's got paintings of Hitler?
I don't, was that a question?
Yeah, that's a question. How would you respond to that?
America, mind your own business. I mean, it's my home. I have, you know, it's my home, my painting, GTFO.
Do you think they have a point?
No, because of what the example you gave me. I mean, if it's presented in my home and it's not some lewd and lascivious painting, then I don't see how it's anyone's business besides my own what artwork I hang up on my walls.
Okay, what if you have two paintings of Hitler, also a signed copy of Hitler's Mein Kampf?
Hold on, are these actual paintings of Hitler?
No, paintings by Hitler. And a signed copy of Mein Kampf.
Okay, now I'm questioning my own moral values and where I stand as a human being, but still, it's inside my home.
Okay, what if you also have, like, a ton of other, like, World War II stuff? You've also got first editions of books by Isaac Newton, Benjamin Franklin. You have a freaking museum at your house. And these Hitler items are just one of, like, thousands of items.
Okay, that sounds a lot better, because up until now I thought I was making some type of Hitler shrine and I was really worried about myself.
Now, I can see how that might be an issue.
Yeah, but if you have, like, collections of fused bullets that hit each other in the air and, like, you know, all these other cool stories about founding fathers and formation of the world and how we have our power structure dynamic built today, and you're, like, memorializing that whole process and Hitler's just a piece of it, that totally makes sense.
Okay, so that kind of changes things for you.
Absolutely.
All right. Well, that's actually a real story. I kid you not. That really happened. Do you know who's running for president? Like the top three people?
I mean, Hillary Clinton.
Now, on the good side.
This show is unbiased, people. Just to let you know, we have complete bipartisan agreements here. I know that, of course, Donald Trump, you have people like Bernie Sanders, Jeb Bush, Chris Christie, Marco Rubio. I know I'm missing about 400 more, but
yeah, you answered the you got the one who I'm talking about, Marco Rubio. And he's the guy that I like. And he went to the Dallas home. They did a fundraiser for him. A guy named Harlan Crow. And, of course, Harlan Crow is a super rich guy. He's like a real estate developer. And he's got a museum at his house. And he's got those items that we talked about. And the head of the Democratic National Committee, I'm sure will come as no shock to you, she felt that what Marco Rubio did by visiting his house was a gross act of disrespect. And
What?
She said that it was disrespectful to visit his house.
Disrespectful to Mr. Crow? Or who is he disrespecting?
To America.
Oh, okay.
Because she's Jewish, and she said, Marco Rubio, you need to cancel that event. It is astounding that the presence of these items that represent horror for millions of Jews the world over would not stop Rubio or anyone else in their tracks when planning this event. That's her quote. I'm sure with that attitude, too.
Yeah, and I'm sure she has. Yeah, okay. And the thing that bothers me is, you know, if it was the first collection you were describing to me, if he had like a mask that he could wear that made himself look like Hitler, or or had glass cases like enshrining Hitler's like dog art or whatever he painted.
No, not the case, man. It's just what I described to you. It's a couple of items among thousands.
Yeah, see, if she describes it that way, then she has no leg to stand on. But it sounds like she's trying to twist it to make it seem like he's, you know, a collector of Nazi Germany.
And he's not. He just has, like, that kind of stuff in his collection because it's – look, man, it's cool. You know what else he's got? And I thought this was awesome because I spent 5 years in Russia. And as you kind of travel around, you see some of the statues that are still up to this day from Soviet times, like full-on like statues with the waving cape in the background of Vladimir Lenin. And when I saw him then, I thought, I want to take one of those home because it just looked cool. He's got one at his house.
No way. How big is it? It
like life-size, dude. They're huge.
Oh.
If you ever go out to like the Soviet bloc, man, they still got them up and they are cool. I mean,
well,
I understand
what
they
represent.
You mean
life size as in like 6 feet tall, or are we talking like huge statues?
Depends. It depends on where you go. There's some that are like life size, like human size, and there's some that are like twice the size. I mean, it depends on where you get them from. But just to hear that this dude's got like a statue of Lenin doing his thing, he usually has like his arm outstretched, you know, like presenting to the world. I mean, they're really majestic statues.
That sounds awesome.
That's what I'm saying. And he's got like a bunch of them from also Stalin and Marx. I think Marx. I lost that in the story, but he's got like a bunch of stuff that after the fall of the Soviet Union, he bought them, which I totally would have done if I had the chance.
And so what you're saying is that you're able to collect these things without agreeing with the type of people who they are, but you're just collecting them because they're a piece of history and are awesome.
That's what I'm saying. I think it's awesome. I don't agree with Lenin. And when I told people in Russia that I wanted that statue, they said, how can you want that statue because of what it represents? And I'm like, I don't agree with the guy. I just want his statue.
So just because it holds that type of vile meaning for other people doesn't necessarily mean that's what the person who owns the object thinks or agrees with.
Absolutely. And that's totally what I agree. And obviously, Harlan Crow thinks the same way since he has that stuff. But he's also got like patriotic stuff, things from America, things from, I mean, both sides. He's got everything.
What was the name of that reporter who lambasted Marco Rubio?
Debbie Wasserman Schultz, head
of
the
she needs
Democratic
to pull the stick out and
National
look
Committee.
Into what else is there in the home, because it seems like he's memorializing history of all aspects, and he's not ignoring any side of it. He's saying these are the events, the leaders, the situations that shaped the world that is today, and here's my memorialization, my museum to represent that. You can't just cut Hitler out of history because you don't like him. He existed, and he should be represented in a what's the word I'm looking for? Appropriate way.
Yeah, he's not haunting your house.
Although that would be scary.
Yes, it would. Well, I saw this story on Bill O'Reilly, the O'Reilly Factor.
Mm-hmm.
And
was he pointing when he told the story?
Shockingly, yes.
Yeah.
With his 9-inch long index finger. All right, so let's just take a moment and listen to some audio from the O'Reilly Factor that aired just a little while ago.
Hi, I'm Bill O'Reilly. Thanks for watching us tonight. The biggest smear so far in the presidential campaign, that is the subject of this evening's Talking Points memo. In a vicious, utterly false attack on Senator Marco Rubio, the head of the Democratic National Committee, Congresswoman Debbie Wasserman Schultz, has reached a new low in political attack discourse. Earlier this week, the senator, Rubio, held a fundraiser at the Dallas home of real estate guy Harlan Crow. Mr. Crow has one of the biggest private collections of historical memorabilia in the world. The collection includes items from the Third Reich, including stuff from Hitler. Wasserman Schultz used that historical collection to smear Rubio. Quote, Rubio is holding this event on the eve of the holiest day of the Jewish calendar, Yom Kippur. Holding an event in a house featuring the artwork and signed autobiography of a man who dedicated his life to extinguishing the Jewish people is the height of insensitivity and indifference. There's really no excuse for such a gross act of disrespect. Mr. Rubio, who, by the way, represents a sizable Jewish population in our home state of Florida, should cancel this tasteless fundraiser. It is astounding that the presence of these items that represent horror for millions of Jews the world over would not stop Mr. Rubio or anyone on his team in their tracks when planning this event. What is truly astounding is the woman's ignorance. I've been to Harlan Crow's home, and I have seen his collection of history. It's amazing. Any museum would be proud to display what he has. Both good and evil are represented in an educational way. There are documents and letters from crucial moments in American history, as well as world history. They include items from villains such as Hitler, Stalin, Tojo, and Saddam Hussein. If you follow Wasserman Schultz's reasoning, no politician could hold an event in, say, the Imperial War Museum in London, for example. Her take is truly insane. By attacking Rubio using the Holocaust, the head of the DNC has shamed herself and her party. She should immediately resign. There comes a point when politics gets so dirty, it corrupts the nation. We are at this point.
Yeah, so I saw Marco Rubio talking about it, and he mentioned that they were talking about the story, and he said that Harlan Crow is obviously not a Nazi sympathizer. He says this is a private citizen, somebody who participates in the political process, and anybody who knows the guy for 2 seconds realizes he's not a Nazi sympathizer. Well, and I kind of had the same opinion that we just talked about right now, so I was working night audit at the time, and I had a lot of time to do those kinds of things. So I wrote him a letter.
Okay.
And I kind of expressed myself the way we have today, and talked a couple of other things. And I could not believe it when just a few weeks later, I received a personal response from Harlan Crow.
Ooh, that looks fancy.
Texas multimillionaire. Oh, and it's written on this like fantastically thick paper. It's like super cool. I'm going to like save it. I'm going to frame
it. Yeah, totally.
So he says, Dear Cliff, the other day I received the letter that you wrote about the silliness in the news on the Rubio fundraiser Hitler picture. I must have read your letter 3 times because I thought it was well written, smart, and high class. In fact, I read your letter to my 17-year-old son, and he said he wanted to be like that guy, meaning you. Now, this is where I stopped and thought, I don't know what to feel about myself when a 17-year-old wants to be like me.
Well, especially when he has a millionaire as a father. It's like, sorry, Dad, I know you've been successful a little bit, but I wanna measure my self-worth with that guy who does a radio show in his basement. Yeah. That's the guy, Dad. Do you take your millions of dollars and your success story and your Hitler painting? I want to live in a garage. Like, yes.
I don't live in a garage. But that's what I was thinking. And of course, I understood that he's not actually saying that he wants to be like me. What he's really saying is that he wants to have that same attitude that I was talking about in my letter, which I'll get to that in a couple of minutes. But he said that he wanted to let me know that he's going to keep my letter and he appreciates my kindness. Best regards, Harlan Crow. And I looked, I swear, I think this is a legit signature. It's written with like a Sharpie marker. Dude, that's awesome. I love that. So
yeah, I mean, especially if you got enough cash to put a full-size statue of Lenin in your house, you have enough cash to have someone write a letter for you. So that he took the personal time to actually write that letter and sign it when he could have had any number of other people do it. That's really cool, man.
That's what I thought. And so I wanted to kind of bring that story here to this show because I think that him, Harlan Crow, and his father, Trammell Crow, are two of this country's greatest businessmen. And most people have never heard of them. Have you ever heard of Harlan Crow or Trammell Crow?
Not until today. No, this is the first introduction I've had.
Yeah, I mean, these guys are big, big time, very influential in the political world, and they shape and affect the direction that this country's going. And I think it's important to see where these guys come from, kind of what they stand for, and the things that they take to heart. Because these are the kind of guys that I look up to, and I love the story because it follows what I really believe, that taking advantages is not a bad thing. It's what you do with the advantages you're given. And his father, Trammell Crow, he was not born rich. He came from a relatively poor family. He was born in 1914. And his story starts with, you know, the way things used to be back in those days, the way I wish it was like that now, but I believe that nobody on earth should be afraid of hard work. But in this country today, there are, and all people, not just young people. I know a lot of people like to say, oh, it's the millennials. It's the people who are lazy and they've got, you know, their own thing going on. But I think today it's people of all ages that feel entitled and they feel like they deserve things that they didn't earn. And I think that a lot of people kind of who feel that way put all, you know, they put advantage into that realm. Like, oh, if you have advantage, you're entitled. Well, that's possible.
What do you mean by advantage? You mean like being white and male?
No, like let's say your dad is super rich and you have every opportunity in the world to do anything you want. Does that automatically make a person entitled?
No, that person still needs to succeed by their own merits.
Yeah, but they have a whole lot more advantages than most people.
Right, but that still shouldn't – just because they have a rich father doesn't mean that they should automatically get the top position when there are hardworking people who are more qualified to fill the role and do better in the role. But I mean that – like just because I said should doesn't mean that's the way it goes. Money talks, you know.
That's true, but I definitely think that – there is a huge difference between opportunity and entitlement. Opportunity says, wow, this amazing advantage, this amazing opportunity that I've been given, and make no mistake, it is a present. It is given to you. But if you feel like you deserve it, if you feel like, you know, well, of course I get the top position, that's entitlement. But if you say, I have an opportunity that maybe other people don't have, now I'm going to make the most of it. I think that is something to be proud of.
Right, so. And that's what I meant. The person needs to succeed by their own merits. It seems like they're taking what tools they're given and using them the best way that they – I mean, if you try to – if you had a nail you're trying to pound into a 2x4 and you got a rock to your right and a big old hammer to your left, which tool are you going to use to pound the nail, you know? And I think anybody should be using the tools that they're given to make the most out of it and be the most successful person that they can be. But, I mean, if you're standing there saying, oh, well, my dad built the hammer, so I'm going to make somebody else hammer it for me. Like, that's – I think that's the whole entitlement versus, you know, succeeding by your own merits.
Exactly. And that's what we're going to talk about when we come back from break. All right. So we're talking about Harlan Crow and his kind of story of him and his father out in the state of Texas, one of the most recognizable states in these United States of America. And we're kind of talking about people who feel entitled,
people who feel like they deserve a certain level of job based on their qualifications or maybe their previous positions or where they come from. But I have an opinion that we as people, and I don't care who you are or what background you come from, you're entitled to nothing. Now, sometimes you get stuff anyway, but I believe it's what you make of what you're given that really makes you good or bad. And we kind of talked about this over the last few weeks. You know the story about how I was general manager of a local hotel here in Fort Collins, and I lost my job. I got let go. And I took a part-time, low-paying job when I didn't need to. I could have gotten actually paid more money by collecting unemployment, but I wanted to earn my paycheck. And I took a part-time job, not making a lot of money, because I would rather, that's how I work, rather than sit at home and collect it for free.
And that's always been how you worked. And I've had the luxury of knowing Clifton. I was born when he was 7. So I got a chance to grow up literally watching Clifton develop over his most formative years. And you've always been that way since as long as I can remember. If you had an opportunity, you did everything you could to get as much as you could from it, but you never expected anything.
Right. But if somebody offered it, I'm like, I'll take
I mean, if somebody offered less, you would use every word in your vocabulary to swindle them into giving you more. If they offered something, you sure as heck took it.
But the thing is I made the most of what I got. And because of that decision, I took that 3-day-a-week night out of position. And it was like 4 weeks later, I'm front desk manager at one of Fort Collins' nicest hotels, just 3 minutes from my house. I mean, I got a promotion. Awesome. Like super fast, you know, and I'm making more money than I did before at a better hotel. I mean, and I'm learning from one of, I believe when he's teaching me, my boss, Jason, I think he's probably one of the best general managers I've ever met in my life. And in learning from him gives me such a great experience because it's kind of like that's something you can't buy, to have a mentor who can give you their knowledge. And I wouldn't be in that position if I had felt entitled.
Right.
And Trammell Crow, who's Harlan's father, was, I believe, the living embodiment of that attitude. He started working at the age of 10 until his father made him stop.
And he's like, wait, why?
Because he's too young. He's like, Trammell, you need to stop working, man. You're 10 years old. Enjoy your childhood. He's like, this is my childhood.
Children lose fingers in that shop. Get out of there.
Well, he plucked chickens. He cleaned bricks. He unloaded boxcars. I mean, this is a kid who couldn't wait to start his life and make something of himself.
I'm thinking of my own son at 8, and I'm like, I can't see him in a loading dock, you know, moving around big old, hey, let me get a drag of that stogie, sir.
And you know what makes this even more amazing? This is before the Great Depression.
Wow. So it's before the large call to have children working.
Right. So when the economy tanks, Trammell's already shown his ability to work hard, especially since, because of the economy, he can't go to college. So he goes and gets a work at a bank during the Great Depression, and he's going to night school for accounting. And by the age of 24, he was the youngest certified accountant in the entire state of Texas in history.
Wow.
And then he joined the U.S. Navy right before World War II broke out, where he worked all during the war as an accountant for the military. I mean, so this guy is like, you know, how can I serve my country? What can I do for it?
And so he took the skills that he had developed on his own and applied them to helping everybody in the country.
Absolutely.
Wow, that's really commendable.
That's what I'm thinking. And then after he even after he leaves the military, he decides, you know, hey, what I learned is great and it's going to serve me in my life. But that's not really where I see my life going. So he starts selling like grains wholesale. And you know, shortly, he's pushing so much grain, he has to triple the sizes of his warehouses. And he's got to build new loading facilities because he's selling so much grain. But unfortunately, that didn't last too long. And the grain business started kind of going downhill. But because of his experiences with warehouses, I mean, he had to build a bunch of new ones, and his accounting experiences, he realizes that, hey, people may not need grain, but people will always need a warehouse, no matter what they're selling. You know, think about today. people aren't warehousing the same things that they warehoused back in the 1930s. But today they're warehousing computers and couches and, you know, new stuff, but they're still warehousing it.
The product may have changed, but the need for a safe storage facility to keep all those products before being sold, that need is still – I think it will always exist as long as there's commerce.
Absolutely. So at the age of 33, younger than I am now, he starts building warehouses and renting the space. Now, at this time, there were other people doing that, but they kind of waited until somebody said, hey, I need a warehouse. Can you build one for me? And then they would build it. He built the warehouse first, believing that his sales force would go out there and find people to rent that space to.
Ballsy.
Right, because if you don't rent that space, you're on the hook for the mortgage. You're on the hook for the building materials. And you could fall flat on your face. But he's like, no, I trust my guys. I trust my business. We'll find the people.
Now, I'm sorry. You said this was in what year? The 1930s now?
This is like the early 1950s.
So we've gone away.
This is right after the war.
Oh, okay. Yeah, because I was just thinking, you know, of course, you know, me only being 28, I only have, you know, modern economy to relate it to. So I'm just trying to think of how much guts it would take to invest, you know, so many millions of today's dollars into building a massive warehouse, pay all those people who you have to pay up front.
On hope.
Yeah, on just, you know, the wing and a prayer that maybe someone will pay me money to use the space. And I'm just like, man, that takes... Talk about taking a risk.
But that it only looks like risk to people who don't have foresight, to people who don't know accounting and they don't know how to forecast and they don't know how to see where the country is headed. Not where it is, but where it's going.
Because, yeah, so like me, people like me.
because this is something that my boss talks to me about. He says a lot of managers in this business and in every business, they let the business dictate the story to them. There's always a story to be told. And the only question is, who's going to tell the story? Is it going to be you by forecasting, understand what's coming, understand where the country is going or where your industry is going, and now you make adjustments to tell the story? Or are you going to let the events of the day dictate the story to you?
Kind of like that old saying, you know, be proactive, not reactive.
Right. And that's Trammell Crow in the late 1940s. And he knew it, for him, it wasn't a risk. For him, he knew. Only people who didn't have that foresight, they felt it was crazy. But he was right, and by the mid-1950s, Trammell Crow was the largest warehouse builder in all of Dallas. He started building skyscrapers in American cities all across the country, and by 1986, he became the largest landlord in the entire country. Have you ever heard of Wyndham Hotels?
Oh, I feel like I should have. I must have heard that sometime in my past. I can't remember it now, though.
Yeah, that was started by Trammell Crow.
That's awesome.
And if you go to Las Vegas, they're like all over the place. When they're a public company. Harlan the Sun took them public, and now they're just a worldwide hotel chain with a great reputation. And have you ever heard of John F. Kennedy?
Yeah, once or twice.
Do you know what happened to him in 1963?
I don't know the year, but I know that he was assassinated.
Yeah. Do you know where he was headed on the day he was assassinated? Do you know where he was going?
I'm going to guess a Wyndham Hotel.
No, he was headed to Trammell Crow's building to give to meet with him and give a speech at one of his warehouses.
Wow.
And obviously he never made it. Because of the tragedy that happened. But I thought it was incredible when I read that that's where he was headed.
Yeah, I thought he was just on parade. I didn't know that he was actually traveling from one destination to another. That's definitely a piece of history I need to brush up on.
Cliff and Brandon back with you. We are speaking about Harlan and Trammell Crow. And, you know, something about this story kind of reminds me of the way, when you're struggling and you're trying to make a business go. It reminds me of not long after I moved to Russia and I decided to start my own English school. And everybody told me I was crazy. I couldn't do it. They said, you didn't understand how Russia works. But I felt like if I put enough work into it, that I could turn it into something. And I started I started making ads and going around to probably every house, every little building in my entire city, and posting ad after ad after ad, and offering, you know, free lessons if you come in, because I felt that if they had an opportunity to come in and talk with me and see what my lessons were like, that they would enjoy it and want to continue. And Yana, one of my Yana, are you with us here today? She might. Oh, yes, Yana, there? Now, you remember those days when, because Yana was my business partner back in the day when we were starting the English school and kind of teaching. You were one of my first students as well. Now, you remember how hard we had to work there at the beginning, don't you?
Of course I remember.
Were things easy?
No, it wasn't easy, of course, to invite people in our class.
But now, after we've been a few years away from it, can you say that it was that you had fun?
Yes, of course I can say that. It was very fun, very interesting, good experience, I think.
Yeah, for me, it's kind of one of those things that are stories that I'll be able to tell my grandchildren about, like, you know, when I was a young man, I lived in Russia and started my own English school, walking the streets, posting advertisements, and have old babushki yelling at me, you know, what are you doing? Arr, get away from here. So it was a good time. And hard work, I believe, pays off. Even if the business doesn't pay off, your experience cannot be duplicated or replaced, because experience is one of those things that no matter what you lose, you can't lose that.
Right. And it's kind of like, you know, how you were talking about Trammell Crowe, how he started off, you know, doing the accounting and then took that experience that he learned from that and flipped it in a whole nother direction. But even though his accounting isn't what eventually made him his success story complete, it still gave him the skills and the experience needed to become successful in the way that he did.
And by the 1980s, there was no question. This guy was a millionaire. He was in a quote by the New York – I'm sorry, not the New York Times. I think it's the Wall Street Journal. But anyway, in a big newspaper, they said that he was the country's largest landlord because he was renting so much space to so many different people. I mean, this guy was an absolute unquestionable success. But guess what? The way you do things, the way you used to do things, doesn't always work forever. And in 1986, the entire country was in trouble. We had a huge recession, a real estate crash. And there were a lot of companies out there that lost everything. I was 6 years old at the time, and you hear it on the news and stuff. I can slightly remember it. They talk about the savings and loan crisis, and everybody was hurting. That was the only time in my knowledge that we were really struggling. And I remember my dad drove me into downtown Sacramento and showed me the long lines outside the soup kitchens, the homeless shelters. And he told me that, hey, a lot of those guys standing there had been like us. And that if I didn't work hard in my life, that could be me too. There were people losing everything all over the place. And anybody is vulnerable to it. And guess what? Trammell Crowe, the empire that he had spent 40 years building, was in trouble right along with the rest of them. And it was not looking good. And a lot of the partners and the investors got together and said, we don't think Trammell, we don't think he's really quite prepared to handle this crisis. And they suggested that maybe he find a successor, somebody who can better navigate the troubles that they found themselves in.
Now, I may have his birth date wrong, but is he in his 60s or 70s at this time?
He was born in 1914, so...
Okay. So know. He's 70, 74-ish?
Yeah, in 1986?
Oh, so, yeah, okay, 70, 72.
Yeah, so he's getting old, you know, it's time to move on. Well, his son, Harlan, had already been working for the company for a couple of years, and he was known at the time as a lazy rich kid. He'd flunked out of his first college. At the age of 25, though, he finally graduated, and he started working for his dad as a leasing agent, you know, because his dad's, like, renting space. He says, all right, son, Let's see how you do. Go rent us some warehouse space. Earn us some money. And a couple of years later, he rose up to be president of the Wyndham Hotel Company, where he stayed until 88. And this is a guy. This is a guy I can really admire. A guy who had fun when he was younger, not like his father.
So he wasn't moving shipping containers at the age of 3 or anything.
No. He actually wanted to have fun. I mean, he wanted to live his life. He's like, hey, I'll be serious later. But when his dad hired him, he understood that playtime was over. And it's probably a lot easier for his father because his father didn't come from money. His father didn't come from privilege. And it was probably tougher for Harlan, who could have felt entitled being the son of a rich man. He could have kicked back and just enjoyed life. You know, a lot of people in this world do that. Because remember, until 1986, there was absolutely no indication that the riches would ever end. So when he took a job, he actually had to work harder than the other guys because they had more experience. They had better qualifications. And the only reason why he got the job is because daddy's the boss. And so he understood that, hey, I've been gifted this opportunity and that it's okay to be given opportunities that you don't deserve. Come on, we all get opportunities that we don't deserve at some point in our lives, don't we?
Well, especially when you started this topic under the premise that nobody's entitled to anything, which, I mean, we can battle semantics and say people are entitled to, you know, their constitutional rights of life, liberty, pursuit of happiness, and things like that. There are certain things we are granted entitlement to, but entitlement to a successful career, placement in a job, no. No, there's no entitlement there. And I think that if you're not entitled to anything, then you're absolutely right. There's just, you know,
viewed as a gift.
We're all granted opportunities that you said, quote, we don't deserve. But it's like, you know, what you do with those opportunities and recognizing them and capitalizing on them. I think that's what gives you a better chance for success.
Right. And that's why I look up to Harlan more than Trammell. Trammell built the company. Trammell built the empire. But Harlan said, I'm not going to let that just sit. And I think that if you are given an opportunity, a great opportunity, it is an obligation to put everything you've got into it and work your ass off to prove that that gift wasn't wasted on you. Because a lot of people, they get something and they waste it. How many people get an inheritance and blow it? It's gone.
Yeah, like,
within years.
Yeah, especially if they're really young, you know. 18, 19 years old, you hand them 50 grand, say goodbye to that in a year.
That sounds strangely personal, Brandon.
Oh, yeah, that might have been coming from a personal story in my distant past. But
so for Harlan.
Nice one.
Well, for Harlan, he understood that his opportunities came because of his last name. So he showed up and he put his heart into it. And because he was determined to show the world that he could make that last name just as proud as his father had. And that is strength. That's something to admire. And in 1988, when a lot of people are worried that the crisis might be too much for Papa Crow to handle on his own, he picked his son, Harlan. And a lot of people go like, oh, great. Well, this is just another example of entitlement.
And out of the frying pan, into the fire.
And he's like, and Harlan's like, you guys don't realize what I've been doing and how hard I've been working. And I liked the quote from his dad that said when he gave him the job, you know, the lower jobs, that he wasn't really grooming him for a replacement, but he was assessing him and seeing how he did and seeing how hard he worked. Because he skipped over, remember, Harlan is like the third son out of five. Maybe that might be four sons. So he skipped over the other boys and he went to Harlan. Because even though it looked like he was going to be the one who was going to be lazy, he turned out to be the hardest worker. Well, I don't know a lot about the other guys, but...
For the sake of this story, you guys are all lazy bums.
Well, you know what? How many newspaper articles do they have written about them?
Right. How many times you've been on the New York Times, brother?
Unless they've been referenced as brother of Harlan Crow. You know, I mean, I'm sure they're successful in whatever they're doing, but it's not luck, you know? That's not gifted to him. He earned that top spot. And we all have that obligation because it doesn't matter what station in life you're in. If you're given an opportunity, no job is too small because you never know what you might learn or who you might might meet. Well, some people think, you know, because my English school is no longer in operation, they go, oh, that was a failure. But the things that I learned and the lessons that I was able to internalize have assisted me in my success today, you know, and there's nothing that I would give up, that I would trade for that, because it's something that's incredibly important to me. So,
well, and the thing you mentioned that really resonates with me was, like, you're saying no job is too small, you know, don't pass an opportunity up. And like, if you take your situation with your hotel management as an example, you took what anybody would look at and say, oh, that's a hard knock situation. You got, you know, released from your job and now you had to take a part-time lower paying job, yada yada. You took what people would see as a bad thing and viewed it as an opportunity that to be capitalized on. And I think that's kind of the underlying message of what you're saying here is, you know, you may not recognize everything as an opportunity, but with hard work and proving yourself and dedication, you may find that luck where you link up with the right person who opens doors for you. Because I think it should be a combination. There's hard work and dedication doesn't always pay off. You got to mix it with meeting the right people and having the right kind of opportunities arise at the right moment for you. But if you're sitting on a couch collecting unemployment, those doors are never going to open.
Yeah, you have to make your own luck. And so even if it looks like a small opportunity, I mean, you got to go for it.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think that, you know, this speech about what you did with your hotel management, I think, is a prime example. And I wanted to compare it to Harlan, but I think that his luck kind of just happened, you know, with his family line, and he really capitalized on it.
Well,
he took
I think the principle applies to everybody. But this brings me to something I've been thinking about. Do you think that the education that you get at Yale or Harvard, do you think that the education is really better than the one you get at Sac State or University of Utah?
Well, okay. So I'm still working on getting into Yale. I don't have any firsthand experience. I'm almost there, but I'm still working on it.
But you know what I'm talking about? Is knowledge different? Is the knowledge that they're teaching different from the knowledge that we get?
Probably not. However, the person teaching the knowledge will be vastly different, and money can get those influential people to sign on to your school.
I think knowledge is knowledge. You know why those schools are so expensive and so prestigious? Because of the connections you get, because of the people who go there. Your roommate might be the future president of the United States. And if he's not the future president, he's probably a future CEO of a giant corporation. You know, these are people who have myriads of connections. And those are connections that money can't buy. Because when you're hanging out being an idiot at school and you go like, wow, the CEO of HP was my former classmate, you know, and when you can pick up the phone and be like, hey, buddy, how you doing? Okay, I can't do that.
Well, you could. They would just be like, who is this guy?
Yeah, they're like, why are you calling me? Yeah, never call me again. And if I call Marco Rubio, he's going to hang up the phone on me. I'll never get to talk with him.
Yeah,
he ain't coming to my house.
Will hang up.
Yeah. I got hung up by Marco Rubio's secretary. But we can make our own luck in whatever our own, you know, small situation is. It's just not on as big of a scale as they are, because we don't have their connections. But we still have the same obligation to put it to good use. So when Papa Crow chooses middle son Harlan to take over, a lot of people thought that's a bad move. But the people who knew him were excited because his father understood what his boy was made of, and he was not promoted out of charity. And in the face of absolute destruction, which a lot of similar companies were destroyed, in a crisis that wiped people out, Harlan Crow made the family business bigger. They owed a lot of money in a lot of different places, and Harlan stared down the lenders, got them to back off when they were going to foreclose on his properties. He sold off other properties. He put his family, including his mother, on a budget and told her what she could and couldn't spend. And you can imagine how Mom felt about that. She's like, you know, we spent all this time rich and now you're going to tell me I can't spend my money? And she thought it's supposed to be the other way around. Parents are supposed to tell the kids what they can spend. And he got a reputation for being ruthless. And he's like, that's not true. You know, it's all about survival. You have to know what's coming and you have to do what it takes to protect what you have so that you can live to fight another day.
That just sounds smart. That doesn't sound ruthless. If I'm making, let's put a lowball number on it. If I'm making $10 a week, am I going to go spend $10 on a Big Mac sandwich meal, or am I going to make that $10 stretch as far as I can on rice and beans?
You're going to make it stretch, and you may not like it, but you're going to say, you know what? We're going to get through this, and we'll be back to where we were and better than ever before. You have to sacrifice when it calls for it. I understand it's hard when you're used to living a certain way, because hard for them was probably like, are you joking?
Yeah, I really want to see what Mama Crow's budget was. It's like, sorry, Mom, you can only spend $300,000 this week. I know it's going to be tough, but I think we'll get through it. And I don't know the situation. I'm just joking. But I mean, I'd like to know what her budget was.
Yeah, I'm betting she didn't miss any meals. But you know what, though? When you're used to a certain lifestyle, it doesn't mean that you don't feel it.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And everything's relative. Everyone has their own struggles. But I can promise you, just to get ridiculous with it, if I'm spending $100 million a month and someone tells me, oh, I'm sorry, you're going to have to survive on, you know, $3,000 instead of $100 million for this month, that's going to be a huge hit. You know, $3,000 a month, we can all survive on in the lower class. But when you're used to living in, you know, in wealth, that's yeah, I can't even put myself in that mind frame.
And no doubt it was bad, because, you know, some of his father's favorite associates, guys who'd been with him for a year, Harlan let him go. They lost their jobs, you know, and you think he liked that?
No. And you know, I worked for some time with a automotive dealership. And there was a person there who had been working there since he was, I believe, 10 years old, and he was 77 at the time I was working there, and they let him go. And I'm like, that was really hard for the managers to admit to. It was really hard for him, who had devoted his life to working in one location. And at 77, what is he going to go do now? What can he get hired for at this point? So he had to basically be forced into retirement. And that was really hard to watch. That was hard to be a part of and witness. I can only imagine having that happen to, you know, being the one to do it to people you're close to and having to do it more than one time.
And then have people say things about you that you go like, that's not true. Because if Harlan had been a softy, that business probably would have not survived.
And then he couldn't be the Nazi supporter that he is today.
Really?
Just kidding. Sorry.
Well, but he could see the future, and he could see what needed to be changed, that things weren't going to be done in the future the same way that they had been done the way his father did it. And he made the necessary changes. His goal was to protect the family fortune behind a fortress wall. And it wasn't until 1993 when people were saying, hey, that company is solid, finally. And built.
It took him like 5 years to get through that.
Yeah, because his dad was known as the charismatic kind of fun guy. Everybody loved him. He made handshake deals, you know. And he's like, we can't do that anymore. I understand that everyone liked that, but we need to change the way we do business. We need to protect ourselves, because his dad made a huge fortune, but he wasn't protected. He was vulnerable. And so Harlan said, I'm going to protect what we've created. And it's one of the most incredible turnaround stories I've ever heard in my life. The more I read about this guy, the more I'm like, how does this story not get told more? You know, and you know what I love the most? After all of it's been done, after everything that he's finished, he's on record as saying that his father is his hero. And wow, all that amazing success that he had never could have happened if his dad hadn't come first and hadn't worked hard and hadn't built it. Not everybody has that, you know, in their corner. And so when I read the letter saying that his boy wants to be like me, that they read the letter and they read it a couple of times. It wasn't just something you go, another letter from some guy, and throw it away. You know, that it makes me proud. You know, it really kind of made me made me stop and think about it. And
I really think it's awesome to hear his story because, you know, like you were saying, you know, Trammell was able to build from the ground up, but it's like Harlan was able to take that what you portrayed as like a party boy attitude, and he was able to transform it into not only continuing a super successful company, but saving it from sure destruction and turning it around into transforming it in only half a decade into something completely different. Well, not different, but managed in a different way. I just think that is really inspiring. Thank you for sharing it with us. I've never heard that story before.
And you know, we've all been through tough times, you know, and so when I hear from the son of the millionaire that he wants to have that same attitude towards work that I expressed, that I talked about, because a lot of things that I said here that we talked about today, I talked about in that letter. And it's, what can I say to a 17-year-old son in a world I'll never live in? You know, I'm like, look at your dad. That is an incredible role model, because I sure as hell look up to the guy. And it makes me want to be a better example to my two sons, because I believe that if you work hard and you study what your dad teaches you, in 20 years, we'll be reading articles in the newspaper about that guy.
Nice.
You know, and you may have a family fortune, but nobody's entitled to it any more than Harlan was entitled to his family's fortune. You know?
Right. Just ask all the families who lost their fortune how much they were entitled to it.
Yeah. You got to do what he did. You need to go out there and show the world that you deserve it, that you're not just taking something, you know, and blowing it. You got to take the gifts and the opportunities and not waste them. But whatever you do, you got to work to be the best at it. And you know, I've long held the idea that if you want to do something, you got to find somebody who's already doing it. And you need to say, hey, can I work for you? When I wanted to be in radio, I got a job working at a radio station. And I was there night and day, all the time, because I wanted to talk to the DJs. I wanted to communicate with them, see how they got into radio. And you know what they told me? They said, doing what you're doing right now, working for no money, working long, ridiculous hours, doing what we tell you to do, bringing us our coffee. Because when you do that stuff, people go, why are you doing that? You're like their slave. No, but I'm learning from them. And, you know, it wasn't long before they said, hey, what do you sound like on the air? And they brought me into the studio. And I was sitting in front of a real microphone, and up to 50,000 people at any given time were listening to my voice because I got the opportunity. And people say, you got lucky. I didn't get lucky. I worked my ass off to get in there. And there were a lot of the other interns.
Literally.
There were a lot of interns who resented me. And they say, why does he get on the air? I've been here longer. I go to more events than he does. And they go, yeah, but you weren't doing what he was doing, bringing me my coffee.
Right.
And taking
Clifton,
my advice.
Clifton literally worked his butt off. And next time I'll have to tell you the story about the cottage cheese and Clifton working his butt off on the air.
Come on, man. So today I want to be a general manager of a hotel, not just a general manager, an effective general manager, you know? And so until the day comes when I can buy my own hotel, I work hard and I learn from the people who are already general managers and who are good general managers, like my boss, Jason. And you know, people like Trammell, Harlan Crow, those are big boys, and they employ people like me. They build and run companies that create things that people want and need. And these are good jobs. And success, my success, your success, is built on the efforts and the people who succeed before you, the people who sign your paychecks and give you the opportunity to learn from them. And you can rest assured that someday you will have the opportunity to sign the paychecks as well. And I really believe that someday I'll be there as well. Maybe not with millions, but I'll have my own measure of success. So kind of figure out what you want in life, find somebody who does it better, and have them teach you. I've never in my life had a situation where somebody flat out refused to give me advice and help me out. Nobody does things alone. Nobody succeeds alone. You still have to do the hard work, but there are always people out there who are willing to give you a hand up. I don't believe in handouts, but I believe in hands up. And they'll bring you along, and that is how you become successful in your own right. You just have to find the right people. So that's the story of Trammell and Harlan Crow. I think it's an incredible American success story.
I agree completely, and I really appreciated hearing it. It gives me kind of an insight in how to conduct myself when learning from other people and understanding that this is a learning opportunity for me, and my chance at the top will come if I continue to work hard and apply myself to whatever study I'm dedicating myself to.
All right, that'll do it for our show today. Thank you for listening. I hope that you enjoyed the show today, and I definitely hope to see you back again next time for more stimulating Native Talk Radio. Have a great week.
The result,
are you joking,
is a form of energy we don't yet know how to control.
I'm not a scientist or a physicist.
The official radio station of the solar system.
I'm a doctor, not an escalator. Spock, give me a hand.
I'm not a scientist, doctor. I'm a Jim, damn it.
Keep saying that. Are you a doctor, aren't you?
Really? Really, really? Okay.
Oh, so you're the dentist.
You're listening to the Puyallup Native Radio Program.